This is The Gay Life on KSAN. Good morning. I'm Randy Alfred. Later in this morning's show, we'll be talking to Steve Bedeau of the California Champions Fund, an organization which raises funds for our lobbyists in Sacramento and in Washington. But our first guests are Bob Havens and Ricardo Isidro of the Gay Lesbian Cuban Refugee Program. Good morning, Bob.
Nice to be here, Randy.
Good morning, Ricardo.
Nice to be here.
Bob, you are the media coordinator for the program, which is kind of under the wing of Metropolitan Community Church, although not an official formal function of it. And Ricardo, you are a recently arrived refugee from Cuba.
Yes.
How long have you been in the Bay Area?
Maybe 3 weeks in San Francisco.
And how long have you been in the United States?
3 months. We're living in Florida, North Florida, and 3 weeks in San Francisco.
Were you one of the people who was on the grounds of the Peruvian embassy when the whole Cuban refugee problem started earlier this spring?
Yes. You won't know about the action in the Peruvian embassy?
Well, I'd be kind of interested to find out how you got to the Peruvian embassy when you found out that there was going to be a possibility for you to leave Cuba.
Really, I don't went in the Peruvian embassy, but I can fight against the policeman in the street. So in Cuba with Rene and other people, many gay people, many young people fight in the street because these people want go to the Peruvian embassy. For me, the Peruvian embassy, the action in the Peruvian embassy was the most important action in the 23 years of the revolution in Cuba, because the people can't see it. So one escape of the oppressive government in Cuba, really.
This was the first real attempt of that many people to escape?
Yes, really. Maybe, think 10,000 people in 3 days, in 2 days, go to the Peruvian embassy. In 2 days. And Fidel closed the Peruvian embassy because he knows in 1 week, so maybe all the people in Cuba go to the Peruvian embassy.
As a gay person, were there specific reasons that you wanted to leave Cuba because of the conditions that gay people live in?
Because the law don't recognize me. The government don't recognize me as a gay person. So my friend too. And I am very proud to be a gay.
When you say they don't recognize you, does that mean that you lose, they won't deal with gayness at all? Or my understanding is that if people are discovered to be gay, they lose the opportunity to be teachers or have responsible jobs and positions, and that as a result people are kept in the closet, as they are, in fact, in most of the United States.
But yes, but it's interesting. If the government don't discover that I am gay, yes, the government can allow me to be a teacher, but I don't like that because I love to be honest. And if I am teacher in Cuba and I am gay, I must live with tension, emotional tension, and really it's not good, it's terrible live so for me.
You're nodding your head, Bob.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that in addition, you made the point that there is some repression of gay people still in the United States, which is very true. One of the things that amazed me when I was told by some of the Cuban refugees was the level of oppression in Cuba. I'll give you a couple of quick examples.
Sure.
There is in Cuba what is known as the Ley de Peligroso, the law of dangerous people. And that law is applied to gay people as well as a number of other groups. But two examples of things that are illegal in Cuba under this law. One of them is having certain mannerisms, as it's called, and that means if a government functionary considers that you are effeminate, then you could be subject to prosecution under this law. Another thing is improper looks at people in the streets. For example, if you are looking in what is considered to be an inappropriate or indecent manner at another human being on the streets, you're considered to be in violation of this law. Now, I should also point out, when you violate the Legge de Peligroso, there is no due process. What happens is you are taken before a magistrate, and if there are witnesses who say you have done this, the case is simply presented against you, and then it is the job of the magistrate to sentence you. American concept of due process, and admittedly in this country, due process doesn't always obtain, but in Cuba, from a formal point of view, the chance to confront your accusers, to have legal counsel in these accusations under the Dangerous People Act, from what we've been told by the refugees, doesn't exist.
That sounds a lot like the Nazi anti-gay laws, which, for instance, in one man was once convicted of, while he was watching a heterosexual couple make love in the park, a police officer said that he was watching only the man. So in the Nazi regime in Germany, he was then taken off and sent off to a concentration camp as a homosexual. Now, there have also been stories that there are concentration camps or their equivalent for gay people in Cuba. Do you know anything about that, Ricardo?
Yes, because Fidel created in the 16 the concentration camp for many people, but especially for gay people. I know. I have a friend. He is now in San Francisco, and he suffered a strong experience in the concentration camp. Nothing to eat, work, and more work. Nothing to do because he is not free. He was not free in the concentration camp. And today, this form is more subtle. Fidel is more. He has been continued the concentration camp, but now is more subtle, more different.
Bob?
Yeah, there's an interesting story about that some of the other refugees have told. One of the group who has already come to the Bay Area was in one of these forced labor internment camps in Cuba during the 1960s and was there when some French journalists came and were interviewing people in the concentration camp. And he tells the story of being interviewed by the French journalists who were outraged at the conditions in these camps, the bad food, the fact that the people were working 12 to 14 hours a day cutting sugar cane. They subsequently went to Havana and talked to Fidel and said, why are you making these people work these long hours simply because of their sexual orientation? And reportedly, Fidel got angry and said, you have 72 hours to leave Cuba. The people, the French journalists, went back to Paris and organized an open letter of protest, which was signed by Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre, among other people, and appeared in 1965 or 1966. And one of the first sentences, which refers to something you mentioned earlier, Randy, one of the first sentences in this open letter to Fidel was, the homosexuals have become your Jews in Cuba, and went on to talk about the conditions and to compare them to the Nazi concentration camps.
It seems almost as if there's some need for regimes that are totalitarian to exclude people in order to define who is inside, that people have to be kind of rigidly forced outside. Yet it seems that – does the anti-gay feeling in Cuba really come from the revolution, or is it simply an institutionalization of – has the revolution included the old Catholic morality in this kind of dedication to traditional – senses of old-fashioned family and old-fashioned masculinity?
The revolution, for me, is not the revolution, because for gay people was a terrible revolution. We don't have rights, any rights to live. And myself, family, my family, don't like that I am gay. My father is very ultra communist. My brother too, not my mother, but I suffer myself. This the government separate all many families from the dot, the son, the, you can understand me? Mm-hmm.
Bob?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question you asked, Randy. And from my talk with several of the refugees and from what I've been able to learn, I would say that what you have in Cuba is a situation where the old-fashioned Spanish, Latino, if you will, new world morality regarding gays, which is rather negative, has been combined with a very organized authoritarian system, so that you have not only the kind of anti-gay feeling that you have in many Latin American countries, but you have added to that, as one example that has come up several times in talking to the refugees, on every block, committees for the defense of the revolution, who, for example, are required by the revolutionary authorities to watch the comings and goings of people. And this has been organized since the revolution. And in the case of one of the refugees who lives in Oakland, he had a lover who had come to live with him from another province in Cuba. And he didn't get along well with the block representatives of the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution. And consequently, the comings and goings of his lover were noted. And he was constantly getting in trouble with these people and at one point, for example, had to pay a fine for having an outsider in his home. And the feeling that he was constantly being watched, these committees had been organized since the revolution, and they were a part of the authoritarian structure that had been set up. And they then gave clout, if you will, to what may have been the traditional Latino cultural feelings on homosexuality, among other things.
Does Fidel have any personal stake in the oppression of homosexuality? I also always hear rumors that his brother Raul is a notorious closet homosexual. Is that a story that makes the rounds in Cuba? Does anyone know any tales that verify that?
Nah, anyone in Cuba know that. I think that Raul, the brother from Fidel, is gay. And I think, my self-opinion, that Fidel maybe is gay because he hates too much the gay people, too much. And I think, I speak with Bob, psychology Lau said, when one person hates too much, one thing is because he is inside.
A lot of the it's interesting, Randy, because that point, I brought it up coming down here with Ricardo and Renee because it's something that a lot of the Cuban refugees have volunteered. And I mean, Cuban refugees from all parts of Cuba who have come from all educational levels. And evidently it is, you know, who knows the actual veracity of it, but it's certainly a point that a number of the people make that perhaps the hostility that has been shown toward gays in Cuba has something to do with the fears or the latencies of Cuba's leaders. I haven't heard so much about Fidel, but I've heard a great deal about Raul Castro.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking to Bob Havens of the Gay Lesbian Cuban Refugee Program and Ricardo Isidro, who is a recently arrived refugee. Ricardo, after you got to this country, you had to go to one of the relocation centers. I hesitate to call them camps because then it begins to sound as if they're replicating the negative conditions that you were leaving in Cuba. How long did you have to spend there? What were the conditions like? How were gay people treated?
In North Florida, 3 months. Real, it's too hot in Florida. I think more hot than in Cuba. But the life real is not so negative. For me, all in the United States, real is very positive because I can see the people, I can hear the music. And my first experience was in the camp when I meet with 2 persons from the MCC, and for me, real was good. I can speak with spoke with this person, and they explained to me what is the MCC. And I was very surprised because, oh, I can't believe you, because, you know, I am a gay and I think too much in God, but it's contradictional, God and gay. And now in the United States, one church for gay people. I can't believe you that. I can't believe that. Real. For me, was great.
Also, it's a church that's been helping your people get out of the relocation centers and in and into homes and so forth. One of the problems with the whole program has been, and a lot of people have been stuck in the camps a long time because there have not been sponsors.
In the camp, real, were problems, but problem with all the different people, not gay people, really. People that come from jail, from jail in Cuba, and these people really are negative person, really is not good person, because I think these people have now the possibility to rehabilitate. Real, now these people can be free, but don't like that and make a strike against the policeman. I saw that. Two men in the camp, take sand and
throw it at people.
Yes, to the policeman in the camp. For me, it's not good.
How soon after the first Cuban refugees arrived did MCC start making contact? Do you know that, Bob?
Well, I know that what prompted the church to become involved with this whole situation was stories that some of the ministers and church people were hearing about conditions, notably not in the camp where Ricardo and Renee were, which is Eglin Air Force Base near Pensacola, Florida, but in Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. There were stories there that the gay people had been segregated for their own protection from the other Cuban refugees. And in fact, later on, when some of the Metropolitan Community Church representatives went to Indiantown Gap, lesbians were afraid to leave the barracks because they weren't sure why these people were coming, and they were so traumatized by some of the negative attitude they had encountered from their fellow Cubans. But in any case, we started hearing these rumors, and on a national level, the decision was made to fund a full-time minister to go into the camps to try to ascertain very specifically how many gay people were in each of the four camps. Administrative support was set up in Los Angeles. And San Francisco was rather unusual in that a local community operating semi-autonomously. We have contact with the national group, but we also bring the refugees directly to San Francisco, which is unusual for the national program, was set up and began functioning and establishing a base in the gay community here in San Francisco.
Okay, now what's the total number of Cuban refugees of all kinds? Do you know that number?
Yeah, as I understand it, Randy, we're talking about 117 to 118,000 at this point.
Okay, now how many of them are identified as gay, either by self-identification or whatever other means there are?
I think that's a very good question because at this point we don't know. It's a really tough question to answer. I can tell you that Reverend Bob Arthur, who was the person who was delegated by MCC to go into the camps.
So he's the national coordinator.
Yeah, he's the national coordinator
of the
Gay, Lesbian, Cuban Refugee Program. And he went into the camps, and as of 3 weeks ago, he had 3,000 names of people who were gays. There was an article in the New York Times, and it quoted some of the refugees in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, who were still left, who were using a Cuban expression about birds hiding their plumage to indicate that a number of the refugees were still not willing to admit their gay identity because they were afraid of what might happen to them here.
And what proportion or what number of gay refugees will be coming to the Bay Area?
I realistically think now that the refugees who will be brought by our program will probably number in the hundreds here to the Bay Area to be resettled. And when we say Bay Area, I want to emphasize that we're talking about as far south as San Jose. We've had interest in Santa Rosa. A number of them have gone into Oakland. So we're talking about the wider Northern California area.
Okay, and that's a far cry from the original estimates of 20,000 gay Cubans are going to move to Castro Street, which is the way the media got the story the first go around.
I think there was a tendency in the early days on the media's part, and I'm not pointing any fingers at anyone, but I did see some news reports to this effect, to sensationalize. We're trying to settle these people all over the United States, and there are active groups in a number of cities. Naturally, the San Francisco area is going to be an area with a large gay community that's committed to helping its own people, and so a number of them will be coming here.
Okay, now what services does the Gay, Lesbian, Cuban Refugee Program provide for newly arrived refugees?
Well, we have services. First of all, of course, to identify sponsors and then to put those sponsors through a screening process to make sure that they understand what's expected of a sponsor, and then to match those who are screened and cleared with refugees. Once the refugees arrive, we have job placement services. We have a culture shock committee which tries to address specifically the problem of leaving Cuban culture and coming into an entirely different cultural situation. We have English training services for refugees, which involve, for example, assigning a tutor to each refugee so that that refugee can be drilled in survival English, the most basic English skills, and later English as second language training, which is a more formal and lengthier process of trying to help the refugees begin to learn English. We have bilingual counseling services for any kinds of psychological problems that might, on an individual basis, crop up that would be, you know, more serious than the usual culture shock problems. And then naturally, the program has all kinds of support services, people who staff telephones or people who do office work or raise funds or, as in my case, our liaison with the media.
Are there any particular connections to the existing gay Latino groups in town? Because we do have those organizations as the GALA, the Gay Latino Alliance, and it seems to me that there would be some wealth of services and support that could be provided there, for instance, in terms of bilingual tutoring and so forth. Or
we've been very fortunate, I think, in making contact with gay Latinos. I should say that gay Latinos and even more specifically gay Cubanos and Cubanas have come forward and are working on an individual basis with the program. I'm not sure about a formal commitment on the part of GALA, but I do know that the officers of GALA and people in GALA have been aware from the very beginning of this situation. And at one of the first meetings, I can say, of the bilingual, bicultural group, there were 90 people, a number of them from GALA, and the word did get out through GALA that we needed people. And the response has been really heartening.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN. We're discussing the problems of the recently arrived Cuban refugees with Ricardo Isidro, who is a refugee himself, and with Bob Havens of the Gay, Lesbian, Cuban Refugee Program. You mentioned an aspect of it that hasn't really been dealt with a lot in the press. Are many of the refugees, the gay refugees, are many of them lesbians?
Our understanding is that there are at least 500 lesbians. I say that because Reverend Arthur has a list of between 400 and 500. In the San Francisco project, we have already brought two lesbians, and we have contacts now with gay women around the Bay Area, and we're trying to develop more sponsorships. And the response has been encouraging. the number of gay women, the camp that we're dealing with now, my understanding is, doesn't have all that many. Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, seems to be the one that has the most.
Another thing you just mentioned was jobs and employment training. One of the things that I remember reading was that there wouldn't be great problems because so many of the refugees were highly skilled, yet the Bay Area has unemployment problems even with highly skilled people because it's so desirable that a lot of professionals are willing to work part-time or for less in the Bay Area than to have a job in Tulsa or Minneapolis. How is that going in terms of obtaining employment for people? It's a critical problem for everyone.
Absolutely. And I have to have really a two-part answer to that. One part is to say that we have been encouraged by the response. We were thinking that most of our effort would be going to people and making a pitch. What has happened in the initial weeks of the program is that several employers came to us and said, we have this job or that job, and can you find us a refugee to fit into this situation? And we have, in fact, recently have set up a job profile interview situation where the refugees come in and they have a long questionnaire, and we get a work profile on each of them and then try to plug them into the jobs that we have. So the first part of my response is to say that there has been an encouraging response by the community, many gays and some non-gays, to try to give jobs to these people. The second part of the response is that we have here in the Bay Area a very large gay community and a very large community, period, and that we always need more jobs. And if there are people listening today who have job situations and want to make a contribution, perhaps you don't feel that you can be a sponsor. Employment is obviously one of the major needs that we have. So please call us at 863-4434.
That's 863-4434, and we'll give you the number again at the end of the interview. What about sponsors? There is still a need for people who are willing to sponsor a refugee.
Absolutely. And Randy, let me make a point about sponsorship, which I think is unclear to many people. And that is that when we talk about sponsorship, we want to make it clear that we can be very flexible with that. There is a group in San Jose called Lambda, which has pledged itself to sponsoring 10 refugees. So in addition to an individual sponsorship, we have organizations that can sponsor refugees. Another kind of sponsorship that we're encouraging is what we call cluster sponsorship. And what this means is that one or two individuals become the sponsors of record, but they recruit a group of other people, and the numbers vary, to help with the financial burden of sponsorship, to give the time and energy that being a good sponsor requires, because there are a lot of bureaucratic functions, there are a lot of simple hosting functions that a sponsor needs to do.
What are the minimal requirements for a sponsor?
Okay. We have our screening committee has set up some guidelines that I can go through real fast. There have been some problems that we try to guard against in our program that have happened in Florida and elsewhere in the nation as the program has gotten going. One of them, there have actually been cases in Florida of people who have been exploited for sexual purposes. And we naturally try to make it clear to prospective sponsors that you're not getting a houseboy who is going to be available for sexual uses unless there's mutual consent, in which case that's everyone's decision to make for themselves if there's mutual consent. Similarly, you're not getting peon labor when you apply for a sponsor. Naturally, we encourage the refugees to do normal household work because we want to integrate them into the economy as quickly as possible and make them independent. We feel this is good, but it's not peonage. Then we want to say that a ballpark economic figure that we're using is $100 to $150 a month expenses connected with the refugees. The initial expenses are more because there are some items of clothing that these people will not have. We have a number of clothes at the church, but naturally we don't have everything that each person is going to need in their size. In addition, of course, there are food and transportation costs and incidental expenses. The refugees are eligible for food stamps, and most of them have received food stamps, and that makes some contribution to the household in terms of food. But there is an economic burden here.
And how long does the sponsor's obligation continue?
We are ballparking 6 months, and we're saying that each sponsor or group of sponsors in their own mind should think in terms of 6 months. That's a ballpark figure, and it will vary from situation to situation.
Okay, so the needs then are for people to be sponsors still.
Mm-hmm.
There are needs for people to provide jobs and or training.
Right. And then
you have a stash of clothes at the church. Presumably that comes from people who have clothes that they can contribute.
Absolutely. And if people in the listening audience have clothing that is in good shape, but for one reason or another they're not using, they can bring it to the Metropolitan Community Church, 150 Eureka Street, San Francisco. And we have a room that we've set aside to take in clothing. And the response has here again been very encouraging. We have quite a few clothes.
Also, there's regular committee meetings of this project that's doing that. When are those held?
There are weekly orientation meetings, again, at the church at 8:30 on Wednesday evenings. And at those meetings, people who are interested in sponsorship or helping in the variety of functions that we have in the project can come, and representatives of the program will explain what we're doing to those people.
Also, do you have any benefits or fundraisers lined up for people who perhaps want to contribute in that way? It always takes money to run a social services program.
Yeah. What I would say on that, Randy, is that it would make sense to call the program, and they would have more up-to-date information on the benefits. And we'll give the phone number, I understand, at the end of the interview. So I'll hold off on that now.
Well, that's about where we're getting, unless there's something you have to add in terms of things you want to say specifically that we haven't covered regarding the Gay Cuban Refugee Program.
Let me just say one thing to gay brothers and sisters out in your listening audience, and that is that we've had some negative publicity in this city recently, the CBS show, which you're very familiar with, Randy. And I think that one way of countering that negative publicity is to indicate that the gay community in San Francisco is a responsible and mature group. We know that. But the publicity that goes out to a lot of people in the country hasn't always said that. And I think by showing the city and the nation that gay people do look after their own brothers and sisters, we can strike a blow, if you will, for our real selves to get that word out to people all over the country. I know that one of the things that has been pointed out about this whole situation is that gay people didn't have the chance to be free in Cuba, and that a kind of mini Holocaust happened, that a lot of gays left because they couldn't be free in Cuba, and that unlike in the 40s, when we couldn't help our gay brothers and sisters, this time we can. And I would urge people in the listening audience to lend us a hand, because you have a real chance now to do something to help your gay brothers and sisters.
Ricardo, is there anything you want to close with?
No, I am very happy to be here because I think I have the opportunity to speak to many persons and so help my brothers, my gay brothers in Cuba.
Okay, once more, if you want to provide any assistance to the refugee program or if you need more information, you can call 863-4434. And I want to thank Bob Havens and Ricardo Isidro for being our guests on The Gay Life this morning.
Good to be here, Randy.
We get something we both know, and we don't talk too much about it. some handsome babies to keep you around, son. Who knows, maybe you were kidnapped, tied up, taken away and held for ransom.
Refugee, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. This is The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco. I'm Randy Alfred, and our next guest is Steve Bedeau, fundraising consultant to the California Champions Fund. Good morning, Steve.
Well, good morning, Randy.
Could you tell us exactly what the California Champions Fund is?
Sure. I guess technically it is a joint fundraising project of California human rights advocates and the Gay Rights National Lobby. And what all that garble means is it's California's way of helping to support a lobbyist for gay rights, both in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C.
Okay, California Human Rights Advocates is the Sacramento Lobby, and Gay Rights National Lobby is the Washington
Correct.
Lobby. And if, as we go on and start using verbal shorthand, if you hear us referring to Gurnal, it's Gay Rights National Lobby, although I haven't heard people refer to CHRA.
Yeah, just as CHRA. So.
How long have these two lobbies been in existence, and what have they accomplished?
Well, they've both been around just a little over 3 years, maybe about 3.5 years. starting with California, some of the things we've accomplished has been mostly stopping bad legislation, such as we were there to stop Senator Briggs when he introduced a bill which would have prohibited gay people from teaching in schools. Therefore, he had to turn to the initiative process.
So that was his first attempt before the initiative process to put it through the state Senate in that first month or so after Anita Bryant's victory in Miami in 77.
Right.
Well, how long has California Human Rights Advocates been on the scene?
Since May of 1977. It was just before Dade County happened, really. We were just starting to organize it when all the Dade County stuff started to happen, which in one sense, for a short period of time, hurt our organizing because it meant a lot of attention went to Dade County. In the other sense, after that happened, I think a lot more people had an awareness of our need to be in many different places politically, including the state legislatures.
How long has Gay Rights National Lobby been around in Washington?
Also about 3.5 years. And it's been responsible for different things, such as holding the first congressional briefings on gay rights in the history of the United States, as a matter of fact, and helping to sponsor the National Convention Project, which made a lot of news recently, and that we had a major effect on the Democratic Party and an increased effect on the Republican Party. And there are a whole host of smaller things that it's done. I think most importantly, about a year and a half ago, the Gay Rights National Lobby hired somebody to be their director who was very talented. And he has been doing some amazing things with the organization, including it is very financially sound, and it's about to start increasing staff. And you're going to hear a lot about the Gay Rights National Lobby.
Why don't you tell us the name of the person that you're giving such credit to?
I'm giving such credit to Steve Endine. And Steve Endine is somebody who actually was the first gay rights lobbyist in the state, in the United States. He lobbied for Minnesota Committee for Gay Rights, which he began in about 1971. And in 1975, he was voted the most effective lobbyist by the Minnesota State Legislature, which says a lot. And we're now fortunate enough to have him in Washington.
You know, Steve, from way back, you have Minnesota days yourself, don't you?
This is the Minnesota administration, I guess.
And you also have a connection to CHRA in the past. Weren't you on their staff at one point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to be an interning lobbyist under Steve Endine. So when I moved here and people began to search for a lobbyist, I was one person who was talked about and eventually became the first director of of CHRA and lived in Sacramento and lobbied there for 2 years.
You've mentioned bills which CHRA has been able to stop. Mm. Have there been any that it has managed to pass?
Well, not pass, but passing bills is a long process. The Willie Brown bill, consenting adults bill, that is, took about 7 years from its conception to its passage. And what we've been working on primarily is AB1 by Assemblyman Art Agnos. And AB1 would basically be an employment rights bill. It would mean you could not discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation on the job. And we've been working on this since the beginning of the organization, which is about 3.5 years ago. And it'll take a few more years before we pass it, but we keep getting further. So.
But that bill does go back even before the establishment of CHRA, because in the form of AB 633, which was Assemblyman Ferrand's bill before he became a state senator, essentially did the same thing.
I agree.
That was up for passage in 74, 75.
Yeah, 75, 76, actually. Okay. And, yeah, to some extent. It was not, I mean, it was just, that was even a very, very, even a sketchier beginning. And you could date it back that far, in which case then the bill has a history of 4 or 5 years. But, you know.
So it's getting towards the point where it should, if we use the Willie Brown bill as a measuring stick. Or do you think this one will take even longer?
Well, I was hoping that we'd have a good chance in the beginning of 81, but I think it's going to, more realistically, it'll be the beginning of 83. And that comes from a lot of things. One of them, a couple of things, one of them being that the whole political climate has just become very, very negative. And, you know, we've lost a number of major seats in the Senate and Assembly, and things just aren't as good as they used to be. A second one is that California Human Rights Advocates has had some problems in funding, which is essentially why I'm here. We've had a history of losing our directors, me and then the person who preceded me, or the person who came after me, rather. So what we're trying to do now is something long-range in plans and significant in terms of the amount of money raised so that we can have a real healthy representation in Sacramento, and that's coming together very nicely. So,
moving on to Gay Rights National Lobby for a moment.
All right.
Has Gay Rights National Lobby managed to pass any bills or stop any bills?
No, and it's going to be much. You about double the length of time when you start talking about national politics, and then it'll be. We're talking about more like 15 years or something like that to pass an amendment to the 64 Civil Rights Act, which is probably the key thrust there. There are other pieces of legislation it's working on, such as S-2210 by Senator Alan Cranston, which would clear up the immigration problems that we're facing right now. But essentially, now it's going to be a long time before we pass anything, especially when you, in light of a recent loss.
The McDonald Amendment?
That's exactly. Basically, what that will do if it passes the Senate, and there's a good chance that it will, is to cut off legal services for poor gay people, is what it comes down to. Basically, it amends the Legal Services Act, and in doing so, says that money for legal services, you know, public money, cannot go to cases that deal with homosexuality. Basically, where those legal services money are used is for people who can't afford legal services through their own means. So it means essentially that if you're straight and you have a legal problem and you don't have any money, the government will help you. But if you're gay and have a legal problem and don't have any money, they won't. So
well, would that apply to gay people? Say someone who got fired from his job for a reason that he didn't think had anything to do with his homosexuality, where homosexuality wasn't an issue, he could still go.
That's possible. I mean, that will take court interpretations. But even so, if you talk about the cases where homosexuality was an issue, I think it's a bit unfair to say not only can you be discriminated against, but you won't even get any help in trying to win your case. So you're sort of being doubly damned by a system if that bill passes.
Have there been any anti-gay bills that GRNL has been able to stop, or was this the first example of one that it needed to and didn't quite have the strength?
Well, it stopped this a couple of years ago, and it may very well stop this in the Senate. It depends. We'll see what happens. I mean, there are a number of different things that are being tried, basically stopping it in the committee or tabling it or a variety of other things, some of which I'm not supposed to even talk about.
Especially on the air.
Yes, because there are a number of fairly intricate strategies. Let's see. Well, right offhand, I haven't been as involved in the Gay Rights National Lobby as I have in CHRA, only in passing and only in trying to raise it money. So I can't think of something that it has stopped.
Gay Rights National Lobby is the organization that was founded at the Chicago conference that David Goodstein called didn't almost come into an existence under a cloud, because in that same call to the conference, he said that he wanted not only to keep quote-unquote gay spoilers out of his organization, and I suppose that anyone has a right to decide who they are willing to politic with and who they are not, but that he wanted to keep gay spoilers, by which he meant, I guess, people who didn't agree with him, leftists, radicals, people in drag or leather, someone who hurts our image, quote-unquote, away from their legislators and off the media. It sounded to me like he was practically announcing a conspiracy to deprive certain people of their civil rights. Because he was going to do it by an organization. What happened at that conference? He had to finally step out of it and let the organization be founded without him?
He got a lot of resistance to the very things that you mentioned. So he basically stepped out of it for a while, and he is coming back into it again. I guess historically what happened after that conference is, because it was such a stormy conference, things did not pull together very well, and the organization limped along for about a year and a half or so, and then Steve Endean finally just, in a large way, came in and took it over and rebuilt it. So the resemblance to what it used to be from what it is today is, you know, is not very great.
Right. Well, in those days, I suppose I was one of the spoilers that Goodstein was talking about, and I seem to have mellowed out since then. I wonder if he's getting back in the organization, if he has as well.
Yeah, I think everybody's mellowed out, I think is what's happened.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking to Steve Bedeau of the California Champions Fund, which is a joint fundraising project of Gay Rights National Lobby and the California Human Rights Advocates. This kind of business of having joint projects is interesting, because Gay Rights National Lobby cooperated with the National Gay Task Force in doing the National Convention project, which was to get as many lesbian and gay delegates and alternates and committee members at the Democratic National Convention and at the Republican Convention as possible, and resulted at the Democratic Convention in a 71 member caucus. I've also heard recently in a press release from National Gay Task Force that they're exploring formal affiliation with Gay Rights Advocates, which is a public interest law firm in San Francisco. Now, Gay Rights National Lobby and California Human Rights Advocates have established a joint fundraising task force or group in California called California Champions Fund. There seems to be a lot of this inter-organizational development going on. What is the task that California Champions Fund has set out? Do you have fundraising goals? What proportion of the funds of each organization do you feel should be raised in California, and specifically by your organization? And how are you going to go about doing it? It's a tall order, I'm
sure. All right. It is. True. Actually, I want to say something about, first of all, just what you were talking about and all the interrelationships going on between the organizations. And that's a really nice sign of health, and it's really good to see that. And I'm a promoter of as many interrelations as we can establish. So symbolically, that's one of the things that the California Champions Fund is doing between the National Lobby and the California Lobby. Specifically, what the California Champions Fund is seeking to do is get to the point where we will be raising a couple hundred thousand a year. And the way we're going to do this is by finding people who are willing to be champions of human rights. That's our motto, sort of. And what a champion of human rights is it's somebody who is willing to donate $10 a month or $50 a month or whatever that individual can donate. And currently the range is from 10 to 100. And by getting 1,000 to 1,500 of people doing this, we will come to the figure of a couple hundred thousand a year. We currently have about 200 people doing this, so we've got a good, strong start on it. And it'll be split between the local lobby and the national lobby evenly. What it'll mean is that we can support with this money about a four-person office in Sacramento, you know, a lobbyist, a director, a field coordinator, somebody to travel around the state, and a secretary, basically a nice little tight office that can pull off what we have to do. And it'll send the equivalent amount of money to the Gay Rights National Lobby to help them with their things. As a matter of fact, the Gay Rights National Lobby's first move is to hire a West Coast director, which will come on staff in about November, thanks to this project.
Would that be a development director, or is there lobbying to be done on a national level out here?
It's both, to help promote the organization, to help develop it, and also to help kind of create a constituent network in California. So if we're if Gernal is having problems with a certain congressperson in California, that then we will already have Gernal will already have the connections to people in that constituency.
So the national equivalent of a field director for the western states.
That's right.
Okay. Now, if you reach this full funding,
mm-hmm.
it would be what proportion of California Human Rights Advocates' budget and what proportion of GRNL's budget? Uh-huh. What have you undertaken
Good
to do?
Question.
What percentage support?
I'm trying to raise probably about 85 to 90% of California Human Rights Advocates' budget. In other words, most of it. And I'm trying to raise something that would approximate 10% of what the Gay Rights National Lobby's budget would be. In other words, California is 10% of the nation, so it should be putting up 10% of the money. And hopefully that Gernal would have about $1 million a year budget eventually. I mean, that's somewhere down the road, but that's what we would target eventually. And, this would provide close to a tenth of that.
But at the moment, the rest of it isn't there, and it would probably be a much larger fraction, wouldn't it?
That's true. For a while, it will be because California is much more developed than the rest of the nation.
Right. We may be 10% of the nation's population, and we may even be 10% mm-hmm. of the nation's gay population, mm-hmm. although I think there's probably already an inflation there mm-hmm. in terms of identified gay population.
Yeah.
But we're certainly far more than that
sure.
in terms of the organized gay community. Mm-hmm. If we were to take an institutional census of the number of organizations mm-hmm. or of the number of members of organizations.
Definitely.
That we would be or the mm-hmm. budgets of organizations.
Yep. Part of the reason for doing the Champions Fund, though, is that it could be easily modeled in other states. So there's nothing stopping us from setting it up in Illinois and New York and some of the most obvious states to begin with. So we help build that. And then as those states build, then we can go out to the smaller states. So it's something that could easily be accomplished in different places. The other way Gernal is raising money is through direct mailing. And it's had some very, very good success doing direct mailings, and that's bringing money out of more than just California, from all over the United States.
How do you answer people who say that the answer is not to work through the system at all, but to work to change the system entirely?
Mm.
That
well,
this kind of liberal civil mm-hmm. rights legislation is not going to benefit anyone mm-hmm. but rich, white, middle-class, banker-type gays
uh-huh.
and men.
Uh-huh.
That's usually tossed in with a criticism.
Yeah. First of all, I mean, there's probably an opinion on that for every person, so what I'm going to be doing is just talking about my opinion on that. And then there are a couple of things to say about my opinion. One is I'm really happy to see people working in many different ways, because that's what a movement is about. A movement isn't about working one type of politics. It's changing attitudes across the spectrum, so that we're not just changing the attitudes of white middle-class men, that we're changing the attitudes of everybody. And if we have a broad range of different types of politics, then we change the attitudes of lots of people. It's also very good to have somebody working within the system and somebody working with on the outside, because the outside people stir things up and get people angry and interested and get things moving, and then the inside people are there to catch them as they're motivated. In terms of are we just liberating white middle-class men, at least the organizations I've been working with have done, I think, a very, very good job of having the decision-making being made by both men and women. And as far as other types of people, like maybe drag queens or other types, I don't think anybody in the organization would look at it as, we're going to pass gay civil rights in exchange for putting down other types of people like that. My opinion is that intolerance or bigotry or whatever is sort of universal. I think if somebody's a bigot, they're liable to be bigoted against many different types. So I would feel totally I would not be comfortable with myself at all if I was supporting gay rights without supporting the rights of anybody to lead whatever kind of life they want to lead and lead it in a secure way.
If people want to get in touch with California Champions Fund
mm-hmm.
or with CHRA or with Gay Rights National Lobby, how would they go about doing that?
The best phone number to use in the Bay Area is 821-4096. The mailing list, or if you want to reach us by mail, the best mailing place would be Sacramento, and that's P.O. Box 1286, Sacramento 95806. So I'll repeat that, and the local number is 821-4096, and the Sacramento P.O. Box is P.O. Box 1286, Sacramento 95806.
Okay, and the California Champions Fund could get anyone in touch with
That's
either
right.
of the two organizations
exactly.
besides that. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for being our guest on The Gay Life this morning, Steve Bedeau.
Well, thank you, Randy Alfred.
And that about wraps it up for another edition of The Gay Life. You just heard Steve Bedeau, a fundraiser for the California Champions Fund, and earlier in the show you heard Ricardo Isidro, a gay Cuban refugee, and Bob Havens of the Cuban Refugee Assistance Program. I'm Randy Alfred, and I produce The Gay Life. I also write a column on live for The Sentinel, which is available in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. The Gay Life would like to know who's listening, so write us if you have any comments, criticisms, or suggestions. Our address is The Gay Life, KSAN, 345 Sansom Street, San Francisco, California, 94104. Once more, that's The Gay Life, KSAN, 345 Sansom Street, San Francisco, 94104. If you're listening on Saturday morning, this show will be repeated late Sunday night at midnight, a new time, midnight on Sunday night. So please tell a friend about The Gay Life on KSAN.